For the rest of the hour, a look back and maybe forward at the life and work of Albert Einstein. March 14th marks the 125th anniversary, 125 years since Einstein was born in Ulm, Germany. And still, nearly 50 years after his death, his image and his influence are everywhere in popular culture and our ideas of what it means to be a scientist and the notebook of scientists working now. His scientific theories are still being tested and refined, and they are the foundations of modern physics. And if you ask somebody the name, a scientific equation, you know, hey, can you name me one scientific equation? Invariably, someone's going to say, oh, E equals MC squared, right? Well, Einstein again here. If you Google him, try this. You Google him on the web, you can get millions of web pages that come up. More than for Charles Darwin or mostly any other scientists that you can name. And when Hollywood wants to portray a genius, Central Casting sends over a white-haired, disheveled caricature of Einstein in his older years. See Christopher Lloyd in Back to the Future. So as his birthday approaches, I think it's a good time to reconsider Einstein and ask this question. If he were alive today, what would he have to say about the state of physics, cosmology, string theory, or world events? You know, Einstein was a very proactive scientist. He was interested in world events and politics. And if he were alive today, what would Einstein say about politics? What would Einstein do about things? Joining me now to talk more about it is Tom Levinson. He is author of Einstein in Berlin, just out in paperback by Bantam Books. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks so much, Ira. It's great to be here.
Tom, how would Einstein react today, do you think, to the world in general or the theories about physics?
Well, Einstein would have reacted to much of the world the way anyone else would have reacted, with a mixture of surprise at, you know, change that is occurring on a ever faster basis, horror at a lot of stuff. I think he would have been, in physics, it's interesting, I think he would have been much more reconciled to modern physics than he was to the physics that had reached the point that it had as he died in 1955.
No, he didn't. He even though he helped invent quantum mechanics, he didn't believe in it wholly, did he? Or is that a myth?
It's not a myth. It's sort of like the old joke about somebody asked a minister if he believed in full immersion baptism, and the minister, who was not from one of those sects, said, "Believe in it. I've seen it done." And you know, Einstein had seen quantum mechanics and seen it done, and in his a marvelous best-selling book on that called The Evolution of Physics that he wrote with a colleague of his named Infeld. It's still a lovely, popular account of the history of physics up to his time. He concedes very graciously, very clearly, that quantum mechanics is, in fact, not self-contradictory. It works. It's a very powerful theory. He makes his dislike for it clear, and he certainly spent the last 30 years of his life trying to find something not that would prove it wrong, but that would subsume it in a kind of physics that he felt he would like much better, that he thought would be more beautiful and more complete. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he failed in that effort, though an awful lot of people today have taken inspiration from that attempt. I don't think they've taken any direct, you know, the people doing string theory and some of the other even more exotic attempts to come up with theories of everything. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure you can get more exotic than string theory. I mean, sort of 10 dimensions and, you know, tiny little things that vibrate on impossibly small scales and so forth and so on is pretty out there. But, you know, certainly that ambition in physics to come up with a complete theory of all the forces in nature, not just all the forces, but all right. the material outcomes in nature we see with our sort of more or less naked eyes, to subsume them all in a single, very simple, very abstract, very powerful theory. That's absolutely Einstein's yeah. program.
Yeah, but Einstein, I remember interviewing people who knew him. You'd give him a problem, he'd say, go away, I give a little tink. I'll go think about it. And he was no great mathematician. And so much of physics today, especially you mentioned string theory, is being taken over by mathematicians. I mean, Einstein did he not see things in his mind and come up with he had a vision and then try to find the mathematics to fit it? It doesn't seem like he would feel comfortable in the world of the mathematicians come physicists these days.
Well, if the Einstein story has a tragic edge to it, and he would have said it didn't, but if it does, it comes on exactly the dividing line that you've just laid out. Einstein was perhaps the greatest ever at imagining very simple physical situations, very, very simple pictures in his mind, moving pictures, that would lay bare an incredibly complex physical situation and lead to a real insight. Special relativity came from a handful of visual images. I mean, obviously there was more work than that, but they started from these very, very powerful images that really made him think about what the problem was in the simplest possible way, in the way that would permit solution. So he had an idea of himself riding along a wave of light. He had that thought at 16. He had really deep insight thinking about, you know, how you can tell what time a train arrives at a station, thinking about what it means to say the train arrives at 11:05, thinking about the clock on the station platform and the train coming in. And these kinds of very simple images led him to incredibly profound thoughts about the fundamental nature of space and time, and all this was the underpinning of the special theory of relativity. Similarly, his theory of gravity was born out of a handful of very simple images, including the rather grim one. He said that he was once sitting in his office at the patent office in Bern, and he saw somebody working on a roof a couple of rooftops away. His office is actually on the top floor of a big building that's still there in Bern. And he said, what would happen if that man fell off the roof? And he sort of didn't pay attention to what would happen when he actually hit the ground. He thought, while he's falling, he's not going to feel his own weight. And that seemingly, almost everyday thought, I mean, just sort of commonplace thought, led him down the road that, with much, trial and error and twists and turns and all kinds of complications, led him to his general theory of relativity, the theory of gravity, the theory that still underpins all of cosmology on the large scale, how the universe fits together.
Mm-hmm. Let me just give an idea. Mm-hmm. We're talking with Tom Levinson this hour about Einstein on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.
But the thing that you say about him having a little tink it's absolutely true. But his little tink for special relativity took him 10 years, and his little tink for general relativity was another 8.
But I'm saying, how would he deal with 11 dimensions in mathematics? He couldn't. He's got to give it. Can he see 11 dimensions in his mind? That's the point I'm trying to wrestle with here.
That's true. And what's interesting, though, is Einstein was one of the very first to deal with multidimensional theories. And some people point to where he went badly off the tracks. That point came when he started playing with theories that he really no longer could visualize. Mm-hmm. I mean, special relativity leads to the first of our multidimensional theories. It's got 4 dimensions, the 3 ordinary ones of space and 1 of time, which were combined in this idea called space-time that's now a commonplace of, Star Trek and almost everyday life. But when he had completed general relativity and was beginning to think about theories that could unify gravity with electricity and magnetism, he started doing that before the quantum mechanical revolution actually happened. He was doing this as early as 1923. And the first ideas he really played with were evolutions of the work of 2 men named Kaluza and Klein who'd worked in 5 dimensions, trying to figure out if you could fold up things into 5 dimensions in such a way that you would get the field equations for both electricity and magnetism and for gravity. Mm-hmm. And at first he thought it was very promising, and then he couldn't make it work. But that was in some ways really the start of his attempt to play with mathematics and see if he could draw physics out of it, instead of doing what you rightly said before, which was think about physics and then look for the mathematics that would help him. Yeah. And I think a lot of people, his contemporaries, looked at him and said, you're really going off the tracks. You can't just sort of logic chop with equations and hope you're going to find something new. I mean, Wolfgang Pauli was contemptuous of this habit of Einstein's. And this is, at a time when Einstein was still regarded as the greatest physicist working. I mean, everybody regarded him as the greatest physicist of the 20th century, but he was still regarded as the greatest physicist working. And it was really no longer true once he gave up on relying on his extraordinarily powerful gifts of physical insight and switched to trying to pursue mathematics as a road into new physical insights. Didn't work anymore.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. We're talking with Tom Levinson, author of Einstein in Berlin, out in paperback by Bantam Books. We're talking about Einstein's legacy and what he might be thinking about today if he were alive. And we'll take your questions. We're going to take a short break, come right back, and go to the phone. So stay with us. Don't go away. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour with Thomas Levinson, author of Einstein in Berlin, just out in paperback by Bantam Books. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can go to the phones. John in Indianapolis. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine.
Good. I just had a couple comments about Einstein and his social issues. First, I'd like to say, you know, I respect the man extremely. I'm a chemistry person, and out of all of my physics classes, it's like reading Greek, so I do have a lot of respect for him and his physics. But I think it's kind of ironic that you were talking earlier about Freud and then also about the DARPA experiments in California and Nevada. But I wanted to call attention to Einstein's social issues, and particularly I thought it was kind of ironic. I was reading a book, and I was reading how in 1932 he attended a conference on making war more acceptable and humanizing it, but he told reporters there that one does not make wars less likely by formulating rules of warfare, and that war cannot be humanized, it can only be abolished. And that's, you know, I obviously respect the man for his scientific endeavors, but also for his great social endeavors as well. And I think if he were alive today, he would be appalled at what's going on, and trying to, you know, with the advent of smart bombs and whatnot, and the fact that they actually aren't smart at all, that, you know, in the first Gulf War, you know, up to 70% of our bombs missed our targets and whatnot.
Yeah, let me get a comment from Tom Levinson. Tom, yeah. How would he react to the social political world today? Any ideas?
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's the question you asked, what would Einstein do, is a phrase that's been rolling around in my head almost since the book was first published in hardcover, my book, you know, 2 or 3 weeks into the Iraq War. And I think he would have had, like most people, a more complicated answer to the problems facing the world than just the sort of stock image of Einstein as a sort of otherworldly pacifist saint. He absolutely loathed war. He saw the technology of war and its development in World War I firsthand. His best friend was the man who essentially invented chemical warfare, Fritz Haber, which he thought was just loathsome, unbelievable. And he certainly felt that the only way to really achieve, you know, the best human future was to find ways to abolish war. And he spent a lot of time in the 20s in particular trying to find ways to make it impossible for the nations of Europe to muster armies large enough to make the kind of war he'd seen in World War I. So, you know, on the one hand, yes, he would have regarded the horrible death toll, not just from the most recent wars, but from, you know, the war a year or more than a war a year we've had since 1945, as just loathsome examples of human stupidity. Mm-hmm. But in 1933, he broke with his pacifist colleagues in recognizing that Adolf Hitler was the kind of menace that you can't wish away by pacifist desires and good words or good intentions. And he became very quickly somebody who said, this is a man who has to be stopped by armed, by force if necessary. So what would he have done in the face of the kind of threat that Saddam Hussein presented? Well, I think, you know, obviously imputing to a great figure views yourself hold is the risk in playing this what would Einstein do game. But given that he was also throughout his life a committed internationalist, I think he would have probably found instances in recent world history where there were monsters on the stage so horrible they would have to have been stopped. Pol Pot comes to mind if Saddam Hussein doesn't rise to your level of mm-hmm. horror. Mm-hmm. What happened in Rwanda comes to mind. But he would have felt, I think, very, very strongly that this is something that should be done as the organized will of the international community. And I think he would have found unilateral action something that he would have just profoundly distrusted.
1-800-989-8255. Frank in Kansas City. Hi, Frank.
Hello. How are you?
Hi.
That's great. I kind of think that Mr. Einstein would probably be interested in dark matter. And I think that he might be interested in what is it and what is its functions in the universe.
Dark energy, too, probably.
Dark matter? Oh, no, I meant dark energy.
That's okay. We'll put them both in one bag and
okay.
Throw them at Tom and see what he says.
Well, just personally, I kind of feel that the most exciting discovery of the year 2003 was the results that came from the WMAP satellite that said, guess what, folks, 96% of our universe is made of stuff. We have no idea what it is, how it got here, what its ultimate function and composition, anything about it. We, you know, 24% or so, 23% dark matter, 73% dark energy, according to the results from that satellite that measures signals from the Big Bang.
So we know less about the universe now than we did when Einstein was alive.
That's right. And I think, in a very real way, it's true. We don't know what happened at time zero. We don't know what banged in the Big Bang. We don't know how we got something out of nothing. There are all kinds of great theories out there. None of them are proven or may even be amenable to proof more than by some aesthetic judgment that they look beautiful. They look, and hence, right.
Yeah.
There's all this stuff in the universe. We have no idea what it is. We don't have any idea, why the proportions fall out the way they do, all this kind of stuff. And I think Einstein would have loved that. I mean, he liked no creative person likes things to be solved. You know, you like to have room to play with and things to exercise your mind and do something exciting with. And I think, Einstein had the great good fortune to emerge in physics at a time when there were huge problems. It was recognized that the foundations of physics didn't make sense. Something had to be done to fix them. And he, more than any other figure in the 20th century, fixed more of physics, from the quantum theory to relativity to things about statistical physics and all. I mean, the reach of his accomplishment, people don't, I think, realize because it all sort of centers on relativity in people's minds. But he would have looked at the situation now as just, he might not have been the right person for this job, but he would have recognized that there was a great and exciting job to do.
What do you think there is about his enduring legacy? Why is everybody, there's somebody, so-and-so is another Einstein. What was there about his overall approach to life and that makes him such a universal symbol?
There are three things, really. One is he really is the last figure who in himself came up with a set of physical ideas that explain so much about how the universe, all of material reality, is organized. George Bernard Shaw, who introduced him at a dinner in the 1930 in London, said, "We used to live in Ptolemy's universe, and that lasted for thousands of years. And then we lived in Newton's universe, and that was 300 years. And now we live in Einstein's universe, and who knows how long that will last." And we still live in Einstein's universe, and we don't know how long it'll last, but it looks pretty good from here. Mm-hmm. So one is, he really is, the greatest kid on the block. Second, he rose to worldwide fame in the immediate wake of World War I. And people today, myself included, have no emotional understanding of what a devastating war that was for the mind and heart and feeling of certainly all of Europe and the United States and to a lesser extent the rest of the world. And along came Einstein, having made this fabulous discovery that did no harm and gave a sense of a human grasp over the universe that was just completely removed from the disaster of the war. And people responded to that, enormously emotionally in 1919, 1920, in the middle of all this devastation. And the last thing is, he hit at the right technological time. In the 200-channel universe, our cultural signals are all broken up. But back then, the mass media was just getting going. And Einstein was one of the first figures to really be publicized around the world in things like the newsreels and by radio sometimes, and in newspaper articles that could be transmitted all over the world so quickly with, undersea cables and so forth. Communications changed greatly just as he was coming into the public eye. And he was, being the first great celebrity means in some ways you're the best known celebrity. He and Charlie mm-hmm. Chaplin and Mary Pickford had that kind of rush to worldwide fame that you almost can't have anymore because we've got so much information flowing around.
Mm-hmm. What strikes me is that I mentioned the central casting image of Einstein as, the wild-haired old guy with the floppy shoes and things and baggy pants. And what people don't know or don't think about is that he did his greatest work when he was in his 20s. I mean, this is not the guy you see in the picture, is it?
That's right. 20s and very sexy. I mean, he was a handsome, flirtatious guy. He knew he was seductive, and he was able to use his charm and wit and humor and lovely eyes and all kinds of stuff. He was a persuasive guy.
Mm-hmm. Talking about Einstein this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News with Tom Levinson, author of Einstein in Berlin, just out in paperback by Bantam Books. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two before we have to go. Let's go to Julie in Carmel, Indiana. Hi, Julie.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You just used the word again, Mr. Levinson, that I like when you're talking about physics and math, and you said beautiful. And you talked about the beauty in this theory and how beautiful something that, you know, he would appreciate it when he saw the beauty in it. And my brother's a physicist, and he's very reserved, but when he starts to talk in mathematical theory, he lights up like some people would when they talked about their children or something. And so it's always fascinated me that he sees a beauty there that maybe the rest of us don't quite get.
I think that was very strongly part of Einstein's, both his sort of mathematical aesthetic or physical aesthetic. Something had to be elegant to him before he thought it was true. It doesn't mean that he didn't require confirmation from nature, but, you know, he really didn't want the universe to be ugly. And at one point he said if his theory was wrong, he'd feel sorry for God because the theory had to be correct.
Yeah, maybe that's something as a non-mathematician, it's hard for me to look at that and say, oh, it's beautiful, you know?
What would he say about this, you know, we talked about dark energy now and that Einstein was right. Would he gloat now that they put that constant back in this, you know, the expansion of the universe? Or would he just say, well, okay, you know, how would he
I think he'd have a complicated reaction, you know, because if he hadn't put it in the first place, he would have successfully predicted the expanding universe, which would have been one of the most astounding predictions to come from really a purely theoretical conception. And he called putting the constant in a blunder, and it really was in that circumstance. There was no physical reason that he knew of that made it necessary, and if he hadn't done it, mm-hmm. he would have had an insight that would have led people to look for what Hubble essentially found by accident. To have it come back sort of through the back door and in some senses purely but mostly driven by observation, I think he would have been pleased, but I don't think he would have had a sense that he could take any credit for it.
Mm-hmm. So go ahead.
Well, the thing about beauty in physics, it is possible, I think, for lay people to appreciate it. I mean, one of the great strengths about Einstein's own popular writing and the writing of a few people, most prominently Richard Feynman, some of his writings for popular writings for physics, The Characteristic of Physical Law, QED, are two short books that people should take a look at if they're interested in. They really capture what a physicist means by beauty, you know, the elegance, the simplicity, the power of an abstraction, and they do so in a way that I think most people can get with pleasure.
Mm-hmm. And did he suffer fools?
Einstein, yeah, he did. I mean, he as long as they weren't fools in everything they did. He didn't expect people to keep up with him in physics. And he didn't like people who nattered or who said just things that were stupid. But he didn't expect people to keep up with him unless they were supposed to.
Because he did hear stories about, you know, being short-tempered with graduate students or people who just didn't get it. You know,
those are pretty much apocryphal. I mean, he didn't do very much teaching ever in his career, but the records from particularly the University of Zurich, where he did his first real teaching, and there's some, you know, some of his students really did write down some memoirs, said he was actually a quite wonderful teacher for a small group, admittedly a small group of quite, you know, quite good students. But he didn't much like teaching. He didn't do very much of it, but he wasn't mean. Mm-hmm. In that sense.
All right. Good place to stop. Tom Levinson, author of Einstein in Berlin, just out in paperback by Bantam Books. Thank you for joining us. And
thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Raise a toast for him this weekend for us, if you're going to be thinking about Einstein.
I will do. In his favorite coffee. Not he wasn't much of a drinker, but he loved his coffee.
He loved his coffee. Well, okay. Then we can all drink, have a cup of coffee with him. Thanks a lot for joining us this hour. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galek and Paul Masiello in New York, Tim Skog in Boston. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Maleski, Alphonse Finn. If you have questions, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We've got the answers there for you. You can look at the links, and also you can get free teaching material. Science Friday's Kids Connection is there. Also, you can download past editions of Science Friday on your Audible player and listen to them at your leisure. And also you can leave us email there and check out the links we have up there for all of our topics. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.